Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Any process of mapping, whether you're mapping the past or the present, and one indeed could say the possibilities for the future, involves choice. And one of the difficulties about choice is it's overly prone for critics to suggest that in the process of choice there is bias, that bias equates with malice, and that this malice needs to be extirpated in order to create a fairer society basking on the sunlit uplands, which are whatever the ideology of those expressing that view holds. And I can see this from a number of angles, both that I have written very extensively about mapping in the past, maps in history, maps in politics, visions of the past, books on the mapping of urban affairs, on land warfare, sea warfare, fortifications, etc., but also actually trying to produce atlases myself, most obviously the DK Atlas of World History. And all of those inevitably entailed the question of choice. And that's what I want to start off by talking about, because I believe that the whole nature of these podcasts is that we, and by we I mean not just Graham and myself, but the listeners, are intelligent people taking part in an intelligent process in which we can engage explicitly with conceptualization, methodology, historiography, and see those as all part of a rational intellectual exercise, instead of making, as so many podcasts do, the past, the present, and the future a matter for triviality and inconsequence. So let's address this issue of the past and how you map it, and by extension, and I will get there, we'll make some comments on the present and the future. But let's focus first on the past, because by the nature of things, the present is only a moment of time on the cusp between past and future, that whilst the future is what we are interested in, we don't have a data set for it. So the past is essentially our data set, our collective memory, and everything else that we've got in order to equip ourselves intellectually. Now, by the nature of things, obviously, mapping involves choice. You are taking at a very different scale the nature of reality as expressed in spatial terms. So at the very largest, your map might be the size of your table. And yet on that map, you might be trying to represent the whole world or a part of it. On top of that, the world, I hope this isn't a surprise to people, I know many listeners of other podcasts are still flat earthers, but as we know, the world is not only a three-dimensional sphere, in fact, as you will know, it's slightly squashed at each of the poles, but essentially a three-dimensional sphere in which we tend to look at in two dimensions with maps. You can look at it in three dimensions with a globe, and globes, in fact, offer a lot. But most people use maps, whatever the format, whether it's in a digital form on a computer screen, or whether it's a hard copy form on whatever medium it is presented. So by the nature of things, you're not only affecting the scale, but you are also bringing up questions of the projection you adopt as part of the strategy of taking three dimensions into two. And then on top of that, you have the very question of perspective. And the perspective is the question of which angle, if you like, you choose to look at the world from. Now, the habitual one we have in the Northern Hemisphere is to put one in which the north is at the top, and indeed in which the zero meridian is generally in the middle of the map. But as you will not be surprised to hear, there is no inherent reason why you should adopt those principles, and therefore cartographic principles, and you can very much vary the impression created if you deal in terms of a different perspective. We can then take that further. you could, in fact, ask interesting questions about what you are trying to show and the map you are presenting. So let me take the most obvious one, which is that most people use maps in order to establish location and direction. I want to go from A to B. I'm not sure where B precisely is, other than as an address. I put it into the phone I carry. That phone will give me a map as a result of an app, and that app will then show me the way to go from A to B. And that is a fit-for-purpose map. It obviously tells you nothing about issues that are of no particular consequence to you, the size of the buildings, for example, that you are going to pass when you go along the road, or even things that might be of consequence to you, but which are not mapped. So, for example, whether you're going through a neighbourhood that might be regarded as dangerous, whatever that means and however that is to be managed, is generally not shown in a directional map. Incidentally, as a contrast, a major road atlas of Britain in 1675 that came out, the Ogilvy one, had for its road maps, and it was essentially an atlas of road maps, it marked woods, and everybody looking at that map would have known that woods meant potentially highwaymen, either horsed or on foot, and that therefore you should be wary of going through them unless you were going through them in a considerable number of people, and ideally by daylight. Well, we don't do that these days, but you know, fitness for purpose for some people might well entail that. Now, these are all fairly obvious points, and these points can be taken further. You could argue, for example, that there is nothing inevitable when you are looking at a map of Britain, or for that matter, Louisiana or Belgium, as to whether if you're going to produce a map of it, you show us the communication routes, road or rail, or in showing possibly both, you put an emphasis on one rather than another. Again, that is a choice. That is a matter of fitness for purpose. But as you will appreciate, for somebody looking at that, they may think that your choice betokens some sort of prejudice. And lastly, before I examine that issue of prejudice slightly more, scaling means that the choices that you make ensure a degree of artificiality in every map. This is not something to do with prejudice. Clearly, if you are reproducing as a small map, let us say Britain, the scale on which you are presenting, let us say the M1, shown as a thickish line on that map, would actually betoken something that in real life was several miles wide. But we are obviously taking part in a scaling activity. And equally, when you are looking at maps, you have to make a choice on what you are depicting, which colours you depict it, what the title you are choosing are, what the key that you are adopting, and so on and so forth. So, you will not be surprised to hear that this entails all sorts of charges of criticism, particularly, though not only, from those who have endorsed what they refer to as critical geopolitics, which is a generally left-wing approach in which geography and spatial considerations are seen to encode, whatever that means, but are seen to encode power relationships and to imply or suggest that these are normative. Well, you know, we can go on and on. I've written a book on geopolitics. I don't wish to repeat or rehearse it. So let me just make an obvious point, which is that all processes of mapping are difficult and that there is not free choice on the part of the map maker. There is information which is available in a spatial fashion. In other words, that piece of information carries with it characteristics, meaning that you can apply it on the map. And there is information which does not take that format. And on top of that, much that people think about is impressionistic, when they're looking at spatiality, i.e. that area is unsafe, or that area is poor, or that area is rich, as opposed to the spatially encoded information, which might be capital values of houses in a particular area, or, if available, the median wealth in that area. So the first point to make is that a lot that you might wish to record, particularly of the past, but actually also of the present, is not available in forms that are spatially encoded or comprehensive or complete. Now, in the 17th century, there was a rather marvellous way of responding to this, which is where you didn't have the data on, say, the coastline, for example, Northeast Asia around Kamchatka, you might leave it white, blank, because you didn't know. Unfortunately, these days, people don't like seeing areas in data sets, and a map is a data set. They don't like seeing information in data sets that are left as white or N stroke A, not available. And therefore, there is an understandable prejudice to conform to where the data is available. Now, that has a whole host of problems. The data itself may be flawed, either because it has been deliberately manipulated, which was, for example, the pattern in the Soviet Union, but is the pattern of some states today, erroneous accounts of issues which suggest that when they're mapped on the global scale, that some of the most implausible societies or states are achieving wonderfully high returns for human rights and so on. Or matters which are not being deliberately manipulated, but which involve issues of intellect. So let me give you an obvious one. And this comes from a conference I attended held by the French Navy to discuss mapping and war some years ago. And there was a presentation about the problems of launching cruise missiles at coastal sites in support of an amphibious operation, an invasion. And in a way, it was a fairly obvious point, but it was the introduction to that paper, which is this, that you program your missiles so that they should land 200 meters behind the coastline. The idea being that that would be where you are most likely to find pillboxes and so on. And we were asked what was the problem with that. And the problem, of course, is a simple one, that different countries use different conventions on maps in presenting where the coastline is. For some people, they present both high water and low water and don't present anything in between. Some people present a kind of median. Some people, in fact, go, particularly at some scales, for a really rather vague notation. And this will all be obvious to you, and you can all think about the similar sort of points. But data sets are not necessarily comparable, both on the international level and within a given state. And of course, one can interrogate them more readily for the present age, in that you can actually ask people why they produced that map. But that may not be possible readily if the further back you go in time. So in other words, it doesn't have to be as a result of malice that data is unreliable, or, pardon the French, crap in, crap out. If you input unreliable data into whatever mapping system you use, and modern mapping systems of a digitalized form can give an astonishing, going through computer systems and GPSs, can give an astonishing, as it were, impression of accuracy. But if the actual data feed has inaccuracies built in, not because they are inaccuracies of the actual way that the map was produced, but because they are inaccuracies in the sense that your perception of them is not comparable to that of the map maker, then producing a result in a more easily comprehensible fashion does not necessarily help you. Now, these are general points that are worthy of consideration before we move on to the, as it were, shall we say, more agitprop approach, which is to look at the politicized debate as to what is covered and how it should be covered. Now, many people will know that that begins at, as it were, the mega level, the debate about the projection that should be used for the presentation of the world, and in particular, the fuss of the time when the Peters projection was advanced about the alleged prejudice bound up in the Mercator one. And I've discussed this in Maps and Politics, and other people have discussed it ably as well. The problem is that there is no one, whatever you mean by accurate projection. But what came from that was the argument, which is now particularly redolent in some circles, that mapping and geography, as conventionally understood, were subjects that, as it were, presented the values of imperialism and replicated those in the modern world. And I'm very aware of this because yesterday on a webinar, I was, as it were, attacked on these very grounds. I think what I would say on that point is that there is no inherent way in which you should necessarily display this information. So if you wanted, for example, a map of the world, past, present, and may one suggest, certainly in the very imminent future, that is linked to population, you would be focusing on China, India, the third country in the world in population terms is the United States, the fourth is Indonesia. So yes, you would be devoting less space to Europe, but you would also be devoting less space to Africa. Now, that would get you into trouble in some circles, but I'm not quite sure how we are supposed to measure or assess the relevance of a emphasis on some areas as opposed to others. And in terms of the historical atlas, there is in practical ways the greater existence of evidence, particularly if you go back in time, for some societies rather than others. And in essence, you would want your evidence to be empirically supported and by more than one source, and that obviously has consequences in terms of what you are going to be showing. So if you're looking at the history of the United States, you can indeed, people have valuably mapped pre-contact Native American societies. But the detail is not, shall we say, as great as that you could offer for the European American society by certainly 1800. And it's not therefore necessarily bad or good that you have a particular emphasis. It may well be prudent and based on what you can show. Again, if you are thinking of the topics to engage with, there are real difficulties depending upon what you tend to think about particular topics or issues. So let us say you were going to be producing a spread in an atlas on the slave trade in, shall we say, the 17th and 18th centuries. Now, obviously, and conventionally at the present moment, there would be a lot of emphasis on the Atlantic slave trade, the movement of enslaved Africans to the New World, to North and South America, which was a significant demographic movement and one of great cruelty and oppression. Goes without saying. But what is striking is, of course, that one tends to see far less attention devoted to the enslavement within Africa of Africans by Africans that was a prelude to that slave trade, or for that matter, the slave trade within Africa itself and the practice of slavery within Africa itself of people that never left the continent, or indeed the comparable movements of slaves from Africa through the Indian Ocean region to Southwest Asia. Now, the point here is that you create a very different impression depending upon what you show. So we end up with a highly flawed assessment of slavery because and of the slave trade, because they are seen largely in terms of some apparently European cultural original sin, instead of being seen as they were, as more widely diffused practices, which were all of them highly reprehensible and unpleasant by modern standards, and one assumes by the standards of the age, but nevertheless, which were not the monopoly of any particular culture. So depending upon what you show, you create a different impression. Now, what that is also the case if you move from, shall we say, an issue like slavery, which tends to be approached in an emotive fashion, which is in a sense a very wrong way to do it, because the thing that you owe those people who were brutally treated is to understand the process as more than an emotional fashion, but that in a rational fashion, to see why it happened and what it meant, and why it was so prevalent. But if let's think of another area, battles, for example. Now, I once edited a book on significant battles, and I found that there were obvious problems, because some of the significant battles that I wish to write about, as I have discussed in a number of publications, were ones in which the information was very limited. There was not the information that permitted the offering of a battle map, and that influenced what we could select. And I thought that was difficult, and I regret that. But nevertheless, accepting that point, and clearly you do want to have a data set that you can use. Nevertheless, what is striking if you look at atlases of battles is how poor they are, because so many of them focus on the same set of battles and the same areas, rather than look, and I'm thinking, for example, of a very inadequate one produced by Richard Overy, rather than looking more widely at battles that were actually important and instructive, but about which we don't necessarily know enough, but we might know enough to still map or discuss. So if you're looking at Indian history, the biggest battle of the 18th century is not, of course, the Battle of Plathy, Robert Clive's defeat of the Nawab of Bengal, but then it's the 1761, it's that the battle, third battle of Panipat, in which the Afghans defeated the Maharathas. Or after that, you'd be looking at 1739 at Karnal, in which Nadir Shah of Persia defeated the Mughal Empire, and so on and so forth. In other words, there is nothing inevitable about the process of choice. And it is reasonable to ask, and here I think that there is an argument that can be made, that we were moving in a relatively good direction in the 1980s and 1990s with figures like William McNeill, the American scholar, or Jerry Bentley, the American scholar, and the Society for World History and the Journal for World History, which he pushed forward at the University of Hawaii, and that these were an attempt to offer world history More recently, Patrick Manning has been doing this, to offer world history in which one saw a number of different cultural areas of enormous significance, and their interaction helped to both establish and actually, as it were, characterize, color in global trends. Now, that I think was a very important and significant intellectual advance. Unfortunately, over the last 10 years in particular, though it begins before then, one has had a trashing of world history, and indeed of much else, by the present-mindedness and partisanship of those who embrace decolonization. And in doing so, what they have done is thrown away the sophistication, the subtlety of world history, its study of the interplay of cultures, and instead have presented an account in which there is good and evil, and what a surprise, that accords with their views, in which there is no room for subtlety, no room for complexity, in which, in some respects, colonization is apparently the nature of modernization, forgetting, for example, issues such as environmental change, technological change, the rise of populations, all of which are arguably more significant. And colonization, of course, scarcely began in the late modern age, or the modern age, whatever you mean by that. One can see it, for example, in the Mediterranean in the time of the ancient Greeks, or for that matter, in with Tang China into Sinkien. But the point I'm making is that the crudity of assessing what is referred to as bias is very much a question of the argument by assertion that is characteristic of those who embrace decolonization. And what I feel, and I'm quite happy for others to say that I am wrong here, because clearly there is room for a multiplicity of opinions, but what I feel is that we've moved a bit backwards. Now, I don't mean by that that history is a linear process, but I do think that world history offered a degree of sophistication that is missing in much of the Western tradition at the present moment, which is so focused at decolonization. I look, for example, at the university I was proud to be a professor of, the University of Exeter, and while there are still some good people there, there are others who, quite frankly, I think I would pay good money not to be taught by. And I find that I'm disappointed here. And what is interesting to me is that when you actually focus on a really, as it were, clear-cut question, what do you put in maps? How do you present the past in a spatial term? Instead of people focusing on the difficulties of doing so, what they do is far more readily decry bias when they don't like what they see, and on the top of that build a kind of victimhood which is as facile as it is childish. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I want to start by almost flipping the question of the role of colonization and the way in which world maps are presented by looking at the other way around, which is to say, looking at non-European, non-Western cartography of the world, crucial period, 15th, 16th, 17th century, how did that seek to depict the Western world, and how well is this studied by modern academia?
Well, let's take the latter point. First of all, there is a superb set of volumes published by the University of Chicago, going back several decades, and they've now got the 19th century ones to do, and then it's brought to fruition. And that includes, and these were relatively early volumes to come out, treatment of East Asian, principally Chinese mapping, of South Asian, principally Indian mapping, and of, if you like, what you might call, I've got to think, search for the word that's appropriate now, but let us say societies that weren't so so far conforming to a stadial theory of social evolution. So societies, for example, in North America. All of those have been covered. And there are strengths and weaknesses in what you might consider the cartographic presentation there. And when I say strengths and weaknesses, I don't mean necessarily to adopt a modern Western perspective. So one of the points I was making yesterday, because these people were really tiresomely present-minded, is that, you know, a lot of cartography in the past, and this is particularly true of what we know of South Asian cartography, but not only them, a lot of European cartography, devoted a lot of attention to the astral sphere, to the heavens, the stars, because that was seen as having direct contact with developments on Earth. In other words, you know, essentially, this movement of the planets would affect your health, the fortunes of societies, the harvest, and so on. And that was therefore more consequential than what might be happening on obscure parts of the world you knew nothing about. So we've got to be very careful. There may well be reasons to depict in maps that conform to social and cultural norms and ideologies that we don't necessarily now respect. And I think it's fair to say, I'm not religious, but I think it's fair to say that one of the great problems of the Western intellectual tradition is that in recent centuries, certainly the last 200 years, it's been overwhelmingly secular in its assumptions. So even people that are, you know, are religious, are devout, nevertheless, their assumptions are that of a rationality in which religious factors don't play a role. And therefore, they tend to consider other societies accordingly, other cultures accordingly. We've got to be careful there. And we've got to be careful not to simplify or primitivize non-Western cultures. Now, going back to the point you asked about, how did they depict the world? It varied. Chinese mapping, for example, and you can write many books on Chinese mapping, but Chinese mapping overwhelmingly was the mapping of China, which of course was a significant area, about 150 million people in 1650, which would roughly, because we're in a pre-census age and it's a question of how you measure Europe, but roughly that would be 2.5 times the size of Europe. So in a sense, mapping China itself was a formidable task. And not surprisingly, and there's been good work on this, the Chinese also were interested in the societies that were near them, but their knowledge of societies at a great distance was somewhat limited. The so-called Chinese voyages of exploration had ended in the, those that are significant that we know about, in the late 1430s. So China's knowledge from that perspective was not necessarily great. I'm not sure whether that necessarily is something that weakens a society. I mean, those who are listening to me will have on their apps, and maybe in the old-fashioned way, A to Z, maps of London or New York, if they live in those places. I doubt that they would be in a position to find themselves readily around Shanghai. You know, in other words, we are necessarily more concerned with the spatial understanding of what is near us. And of course, that was famously satirized in a brilliant cartoon in The New Yorker of the New Yorker's view of the United States. So that, I think, is normal. If you're looking at the Ottoman Empire, there's been good work, particularly, but not only, by Gabor Agustin, of the spatial understanding by the Ottomans of other societies. They produced a number of atlases, principally maritime atlases, and they were actually, you know, fairly well informed of the borderlands and the areas beyond those borderlands. But that did not necessarily mean that they had a global picture of the world in which you could fill in all the pieces.
Well, from a question about the past to a question about the present and expectation from the future, Given that with advances in GPS, we can use satellite images, you know, on our mobile phone to navigate ourselves around from A to B, almost wherever we are in the world, other than in a few very remote or kind of off out of bounds areas. Is the art of cartography a dead one in that respect? And in future, the art and science of maps will be in thematic map making, or do you think there is still a future in cartography as a means of allowing people from getting to A and B and to understand the topography in which they find themselves?
Well, cartography is about much more than getting from A to B, and you might argue that with the world literally getting more crowded, we've just gone to 8 billion people and we're projected to rise to significantly above 10 billion, you might argue that actually the spatial understanding of distributions, whatever those are, is more significant than ever in the past. It's certainly the case that, yes, satellite and other aerial forms can give you ready access to all sorts of information. That does not obviate the need to decide how best to present, categorize, explain, and analyze that information. And all of those are part of cartographic science. So I would say that cartography is not in decline. I would say it is more necessary, but I would say that the noise being presented by the decolonizers does not help, because what it does, as indeed in many other spheres of life, is not only offer a crudity in analysis, but it also forces upon institutions a disproportionate time of sort of honoring a particular set of rather obtuse and often rather ignorant suppositions. As far as cartography in the future is concerned, it will be multi-purpose. There will be, as it is at the moment, the military matters will be very significant, and as you will know, a major use of drones is for reconnaissance, and what you've got is just-in-time mapping, which I think is tremendously significant. It's not new. There was just-in-time mapping, of course, has been going for several decades, but it's now more and more important in time in terms of sensor and fire systems. So those, I think, are important. But I think cartography also exists in the interplay between the mental mapping in which we understand the immediate world and the more distant world, and the way in which there are systems for validating, querying, or asserting those particular views.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. Professor Jeremy Black, whose latest book on maps is A History of Britain in 100 Maps, which is published by the British Library and is in all good bookshops now. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.